to item five. We're not taking a break. We did that. Update on Skagit Elk. I think we got enough chairs up here for the list of participants, Amy.
Rotate people.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Welcome, Amy.
Thank you. Tammy. This is from the Skagit Academy.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for the signs.
Good morning. My name is Amy Windrope. I'm the regional director for Northern Puget Sound. And I actually first met Chair Carpenter. The very first time I met him was at an elk meeting.
Yeah.
I also want to take a moment and recognize Chair Carpenter and Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Holzmiller for the engagement that the three of you have in this issue and the appreciation that I have for the guidance, the conversations that we've had over the last couple of years. So thank you very much. I'm here with Fenner Yarborough, who is going to help me with this presentation. He is the Wildlife Program Manager for Region 4. Come Monday, he is going to be the Acting Regional Director for Region 4, so just so you know. So we have been working for the last couple of years on what we're calling our North Star. And our North Star is that we want to address the impacts to agriculture in a way that works for the community and our tribal co-managers. This issue around elk in the Skagit Valley has been an issue for over a century. The elk have used this valley since time immemorial. We know this from three different strands of evidence: archaeological, anthropological, and from the Department of Game, and from the Skagit County Game Commission, which left us some good records. And the story of this herd is essentially a story of extirpation, reintroduction, damage to ag, extirpation, reintroduction, and damage to ag, on sort of a cyclical nature over the last century. So part of our job is to recognize and communicate that elk are part of this ecosystem and that we must protect the working lands of the Skagit Valley. These working farms are part of our collective conservation vision. These farmers are conservation partners in many different ways, and we must address their concerns to keep them on the landscape. I also want to take a moment to recognize the Point Elliott Treaty. The treaty reserved the right of the tribes to hunt and gather on open and unclaimed lands in the ceded territory, and they maintain the right to manage the resources. We co-manage the fish and wildlife because the resources we manage move between us and across this landscape, and we must manage them together. Thus, we co-manage, meaning that we gather together and try to find consensus, we share information, and we endeavor to work in partnership. Because we share the same goal with our co-managers, we want a thriving Washington ecosystem with abundant fish and wildlife. So to move forward on these elk issues, we have listened and we've heard from the concerns of the community. We have heard the request of this commission to become more specific and to provide an action plan with metrics. So we have developed an action plan that we're going to talk a little bit about today. We've developed it in conversation with our Point Elliott Treaty tribe, tribal members, and it reflects a deal that we have struck with the Skagit County. We've met multiple times with Skagit County leadership to find a path forward, and we believe that in dialogue with the Point Elliott Treaty tribes, this plan reflects a collective agreement between the Skagit County, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Point Elliott Treaty tribes. I also want to speak to the reality that this issue is fraught, and it lends itself to hyperbole. So we want to stay focused on the data and developing our solutions. So we're going to try to provide some of that today. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Fenner.
Thank you. Does that work?
Get a little closer.
So I'll go through a little bit about, I won't spend a whole lot of time because we have a lot of other panel members, talk a little bit about where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. So the North Cascades elk herd, commonly referred to as the Nooksack elk herd, our current population of our survey area, which I'll talk a little bit about the survey area in a few minutes, is 1,500. Our population objective from the last herd plan that was signed last year was between 1,700 and 2,000. And as Amy mentioned, it's co-managed with the Point Elliott Treaty tribes. So elk have used the Skagit Valley since time immemorial. I won't go through all the releases, but just to give you kind of some insight on what we've done over the years, with 2005 being the last one with 51 elk from Mount St. Helens. So some history of the herd. It declined from a high of about 1,400 to 2,000 in 84 to only a few hundred in the 90s. We had a harvest moratorium from 97 to 2006. We talked a little bit about the population augmentations, and the current population is expanding. So just to give you a little overview of what we're looking at, if you're not familiar with the area, this is the green is the herd area. Right here is the survey area, so that's what we fly in cooperation with the Point Allen Treaty Tribes helicopter survey every year. This kind of purple-pink-orange area is Elk Area 4941, which is special permit only. 418 is special permit only, same with 437, and the other GMU, 407 and 448, are general season. So just a brief overview of the herd area and what we're talking about. So kind of to summarize real briefly on the elk damage information on what what's been occurring since 2015, I think the important thing here to look at is this past year with 2018, we had 66 number of kill permits issued with a total harvest of 30. So we're getting we only have about 50% of landowner harvest. So that's been a little bit of a concern to us. We've increased total permits every year for the last, since 2015. So before 2013, the damage program was managed by enforcement program. Since 2013, it's been managed by the conflict program, which is in wildlife. Again, our number of damage permits have increased each year since 2015, and we're still only at about 50% of landowner harvest. That doesn't include our master hunters. That doesn't include our youth, senior, and disabled permits for 4941. So that's just landowner harvest. So this is Hearn Field on the side of Highway 20. Just to kind of touch on some of the other things that are happening in the community, there are many in the Skagit community that love elk. We have property owners purchasing large tracts of land for elk and closing them to hunting, which creates some challenges for us and for the tribes.
I don't know what Hearn Field is.
So Hearn Field, this is owned by Skagit Land Trust. It's mowed, it provides elk forage, it's right along Highway 20, and it's off limits to hunting. Again, we have an active land trust that's closing lands to elk hunting that's right in the middle of the agricultural land. We have landowners planting forage for elk. So these could be right next to a landowner that's experiencing damage. So we have a lot of challenges to try to meet all the needs of the community. So some of our recent efforts, we have increased our community and stakeholder involvement to talk about management, conservation, and social tolerance. We've had meetings with the community that have been well attended. We've provided over 85,000 linear feet of fencing materials to landowners, and we've increased our co-manager discussions specifically to talk about damage issues. So now to get into just kind of the main points of the action plan. I think you have the action plan in your binder that goes into more details, but we'll kind of touch on some of the things we're talking about for 2019-2020. So one of the issues we're talking about is to issue these damage permits preemptively to qualifying landowners. We've gotten some feedback from folks that they'll have elk on their property, our conflict specialist will come out, issue a permit, and then the elk are gone. So we feel like we can get ahead of that a little bit to the properties that have chronic damage and issue them permits at the beginning of the conflict season. We've worked pretty well with Representative Eslick to revise our compensation forms and damage prevention cooperative agreements. Some of these forms can be a little complicated. So we're working on kind of streamlining those, getting rid of some of the language that people had concerns about regarding no trespassing signs or requirements for public hunting. So we're hoping to have all those done here shortly. Another point is landowner access fees. I think Skagit County will talk a little bit about that, but kind of showcasing that landowners can charge for access, not for the permit, but can charge for access. We're also going to be more aggressive on hoof disease removals. We've had more reports lately. I think we can do a better job as an agency on educating the public on hoof disease, how to report, where to report, and we can be more aggressive in our removals and response. We're going to request increased discussions with DOT about signage, speed limits, outreach. We talk with them fairly often, but they haven't been a huge player yet, so we'd like to kind of involve them a lot more on the public safety issue. That issue is shared amongst the whole community, so that's something we can absolutely improve on. You have a map in your packet that's a tool that the Swinomish Tribe has worked in collaboration with us. It's really in its infancy. We just started working on this. Tino might talk a little bit about it later, but this just gives you an overview of the situation and how difficult it is with land ownership. Some of the properties in Brown are DPCA properties, so open for hunting and for us to address the issue. And the amount of the other colors is increasing every year, which is off limits to hunting and private property that don't allow hunting. So just gives you a kind of a snapshot of the puzzle a little bit. And the thing I'll talk the most about is this idea that we're really wanting to push forward called targeted neighborhood management. So we'd really like to identify and hit those resident elk groups in agricultural areas. These are the groups that spend all their time in a certain area, don't go back up in the hills, really just focus in these specific areas and cause the majority of damage. I think we can increase our pressure using non-lethal and lethal techniques to really hit those groups. They're increasing in size, and these are the ones we want to hit. We've identified four or five neighborhoods that we figure that we can really hit hard this year. This is an example here of the Hamilton area. So if we can work with landowner permission and in cooperation, we can get DPCA set up across multiple properties, and this will allow access for landowners and for recreational hunters to go across properties and hunt multiple properties. We get a lot of feedback that, well, we hunt on my property and they just go next door. And that is absolutely true. But if we get ahead of that and get these DPCAs going, pulling in all these properties, of course with landowner permission, we increase our huntable area and hopefully get some of these groups moved out of there. We would like to increase tribal participation in this. They're a vital partner, and so we're hoping they can really help us with addressing this issue. So some of the metrics we've talked about, we'd like to reduce the number of elk damage complaints from 2018 levels in these designated neighborhoods. Like I said, we've identified five so far that have big areas of DPCA, so huntable land. We'd like to focus the majority of our damage harvest in these neighborhoods instead of just kind of putting out fires here and there, really focusing all our time and effort in these targeted neighborhoods. As I mentioned, we'd like to increase the number of requests to tribes to participate in hazing or harvest. We're hoping to respond to limping elk reports within 7 days with timely removal if hoof disease is suspected. We can go out, take a look, decide if it's hoof disease, decide if it's just an injury, and figure out what to do next, whether that's lethal removal or not. And we've also gotten a lot of feedback that people don't know who to call when they see a collision or see an accident with an elk. So we can increase outreach to really get that number out there so we can have a better handle on what's happening with roadkill. Those are the major points that I had. It goes into more detail in the action plan, but for time and for everyone else here, I thought I'd just hit the high points.
All right. Okay. Mr. Thorburn.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick. I understand that we have a lot of good testimony to hear. But so looking at your the points that you brought up on the action plan, the summary points, the issue of the preemptive issuing of damage permits, revising the compensation forms, and also this targeted neighborhood approach. It sounds like it is actually making revisions to a lot of our conflict management statewide or potentially statewide. Is that the thought that as we change these things, they may be taken? The notion of preemptive damage permits is very intriguing, I think, because I hear all the time, well, you know, I call the elks in my orchard, and by the time, you know, we can get the permit and the hunter, the elk's gone. So there's some really intriguing thought that's gone into this, and I'm just wondering about it. Will this be a pilot and maybe look at this statewide? Or
I think we should view it as a pilot, and we also need to view it in in the context of this map, that we're not preemptively, if you call and you have a problem and we haven't heard from you before,
yeah,
we're not likely to give you a damage permit. So we know this valley pretty well, and we know which property owners are hit most often, and that's where we're targeting.
Yeah.
So I don't see it as a broad change. I think it's a targeted approach here, and we'll see if it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Holzmiller.
But in all seriousness, it isn't like they're reinventing the wheel, because here 10, 15 years ago, we were having real issues with elk, and that's the way it was done. We were given landowner permits right off the get-go. So, I mean, no, it isn't some new technology. I appreciate what you're doing, Amy. I think this helps, because there again, it gives it to the landowner. You don't have a whole bunch of hoops to jump through. Because there again, it's a 95-degree day. You really don't want to be shooting an elk, but when you can get the situations right, you can do it. So, yes.
Mr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your last slide of metrics, this looks a little bit like goals of the program, perhaps. And so two questions. The first one, reduce the number, but it doesn't say by how much. And if there was a goal of reducing it by 25% or 50%, or I'm sure it's more than 1%, I wondered about why there isn't a particular target there if this is a goal statement. And then there's also no metric here on the number of permits that are filled. You mentioned only 50% being filled. Mm. Why would that not be a goal to get 100% of those filled?
So these are metrics without hard numbers on them because we're not really sure how this is going to work out. So part of this is, okay, let's see what the reduction we can get with full effort and with our Point Elliott Treaty tribes and with the communities. So we were leery to put a number that was unrealistic because we're not sure what the right numbers are. So that's why you don't see numbers. The other piece about
increasing.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
So we could add it. It's a good idea.
Yeah.
It's tough. You know, we can give a landowner a permit, and but we can't pull the trigger. We can work with them. We can get master hunters out there to help with success. So somebody that, you know, doesn't have to go to work or can be there 7 days a week. So we can help with that, but a lot of it is up to the landowner to pull the trigger if they have the damage permit.
Yeah, I just asked the question in terms of a goal statement. What are you hoping to achieve? A quantitative thing that can be evaluated later. Did we succeed or not?
I'd like to, you know, obviously hear from the rest of the folks in the room, but if this is a pilot like Commissioner Thorburn suggested, articulated, that's a good vision. Do we have a time, if we do it that way, as a pilot, do we have a timeline attached to it, or I think we should do that? Just a thought going forward.
Yeah, we appreciate that. I think 1 year. Let's try it for a year and see
Perfect.
What we get.
That was my thought as well.
One quick thought. Don, as far as the numbers, because there again, having lived this in my world, there's guys that just like money are going to fill their elk tags, and then there's guys that come and take them and never going to do it. So to get 100%, that isn't realistic. There again, and back to the numbers game, and one of the producers in this area and I had the same conversation because we started talking numbers. We've got two dynamics working here. We've got landowners that don't want the elk and don't want the damage, but we have tribal people that want the elk so they can harvest them. So we start putting numbers, I think we tie ourselves in knots. What we're looking to do is reduce elk damage. It doesn't matter if we have to take care of 5, 50, 500. If we can end up reducing the damage, that's the goal to this. So I'm afraid if we start throwing numbers on this, we can water ourselves up pretty quickly.
Okay, moving along.
Thank you very much for having us here today. I'm Ron Wason, Skagit County Commissioner for one of this area here. I've been involved with this for quite a while. I really do appreciate the time and effort gone into this. I think one of the things is the goal. What are we trying to accomplish? As I was mentioned before, we have property owners that want the elk there. We have property owners who don't. So for my goal is we want to make sure the property owners that are getting damaged has reduced the number of damage. And I think we need to be able to adapt to changes because any wildlife will change their behavior based upon what they are experiencing. So if we have good food on this property because he's trying to raise beef, but over here we just want to have pasture, are they doing the proper things to get the great nutrient value out of that pasture when they're not really managing it, they just have the pasture there. And so I think we need to work together. And that was one of the things we worked on with Will Honey here. What can we do to help those property owners who want to reduce the damage on their property to make sure that happens? And I think we just have to adapt a little bit going forward. And we aren't going to be able to say tomorrow it's not going to happen anymore. But some of the metrics here are if people are frustrated, they don't call anymore because you know nothing's going to happen. That's not really a good metric to measure. And so we need to look at more of is the damage happening and what can we do to reduce that damage on people who do not want damage on their property. So, Will, do you have some more things to add on?
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Will Honey. I'm a deputy prosecuting attorney with Skagit County. I'm also a landowner. I'm a hunter. I participated in these damage hunts. Spend a lot of time hiking around in the woods above the valley, so I kind of have a pretty good feel for the situation. And the commissioners asked me to look at this and work with the department and come up with some proposals that are going to work for our landowners, try to bring us together around a solution. I think from the starting point is just simply an objective look at why is this happening? It didn't used to happen, and now it's happening. What was going on previously, and I'm talking about 10, 20 years ago, was, as some of you know, there would be just kind of a free-for-all open season on the valley floor. And it really led to some bad results and some, I think, for lack of a better term, PR disasters. It was effective in getting the resident herds out of there, though. And of course, kind of the conclusion of that, we've also had a shift to where, and we're not sure how this decision was made, and it's in some sense not relevant at this point, but we have all of the Point Elliott Treaty tribes hunting essentially in our valley. And that creates a different dynamic than if we were simply working with, I guess this is maybe a bit of a plea for localism, if the treaties don't mean anything, if they don't mean a particular relationship between a particular Aboriginal band and a particular ecosystem. And the idea that we have all of these tribes in the valley requires more elk, and they hunt on the side hills. They have access to Sierra Pacific and DNR, and there's a lot of acreage. And then there's this little narrow belt of green grass down in the bottomland. So the additional elk and the additional pressure and the reduction of the pressure on the valley floor is that's what's caused this situation. And so what's the solution? We think it's just more pressure on the valley floor, and I think the department folks would agree with that, researching what other jurisdictions, other states, other places with this problem, how they've dealt with it. And so how do we do that? The damage tag, so what we looked at is the damage tag issue. There is this question of low success rate. Why, we're giving out 66 tags, why are only 30 of them filled? There's a couple reasons. One was a lot of landowners weren't clear that they didn't have to give up public access to participate in this. That language was in some of the agreements tied to cash compensation, but it's not a necessary component of the damage permit thing. So that's folks just aren't participating in it in the first place. And then once they do get a damage tag, maybe it's interesting to go shoot an elk, but then on the third or fourth one, it's a significant undertaking. Obviously, we don't want people killing elk and leaving them for the vultures. That'd be illegal, first of all. These elk have to be processed and dealt with. And if you're a landowner or a rancher doing this multiple times, it's just not realistic. You have work to do. Making clear that landowners can designate other folks that they deem competent to come onto the property and to harvest these elk, and setting it up so that it's just a matter of a phone call rather than damage, I have to get a tag, so these tags are on hand. I think finally, what it, you know, one of the realizations I came to, I went out and filled a damage tag a few years ago with George Vojkovich, Skagit River Ranch. He has a lot of depredation on his elk depredation on his property. He was my neighbor, and it was a great experience. He fed me breakfast, went out and harvested an elk. But at the end of this, and he loaded it up in my truck with a tractor, but at the end of this, he'd spent all day long guiding me. You know, you have to have somebody on these smaller parcels that knows what's going on. Here are the elk. There's a house through that tree line. You can't just turn people loose. So it's just kind of a dead weight loss for him. So one of the ideas we brought to the table in this is that landowners should be able to charge an access fee so they can recoup their lost time. Now, the overarching goal in all of this, it's not to set up an alternative hunting program. It's to put pressure on the valley floor, and in every way possible. You know, that hopefully could include tribal folks. At least the Upper Skagit haven't expressed much interest in hunting on the valley floor. They like being in the uplands. So we support what the department's brought forward, and it's a negotiated thing that we work through. So we want to see how it works and whether it will have any effect. Obviously, folks are going to have to participate in it. Everyone's going to have to act in good faith and in order for it to work. So the amalgamation of the lands so that folks can move around on different properties, that's good. That'll be helpful. And then the other piece is, you know, it's come up. Some of the tribal representatives have suggested, well, this increase in harvest is going to jeopardize treaty rights. We don't think it necessarily needs to. What we do think is that there needs to be a very specific, deliberate policy of focusing any and all harvest to the extent possible on the valley floor. There are non-treaty tags that are given out in this area, and they typically involve folks going in the uplands and the national forest and so forth and hunting. We think that harvest, non-tribal harvest, should be focused on the valley floor. There are blocks of national forest. There's a 1,000-acre piece of national forest, Forest Service owned ground in the middle of Skagit where the elk hang out constantly. Somebody who doesn't own land could just as well hunt there and put pressure on those elk. So there are a lot of these refugia within the middle of Skagit are actually publicly owned. They're not all Skagit Land Trust. Ross Island, Skyu Island, all of this. So, bring it to a conclusion, we think this is a good approach. It's a good start, but we'd really like to see a deliberate policy of just focusing any and all harvest to the fullest extent possible, tribal and non-tribal, on the valley floor. So, subject to your questions, that's all I had.
Good morning, Chairman Carpenter. Ladies and gentlemen of the commission, I'm Danny DeFranco. I took over for Sarah Ryan as the executive VP of the Washington State Cattlemen's Association, and I look forward to working with you guys in the future. As I'm coming in midstream, I did a bunch of reading on this particular issue in Skagit Valley, and I've also had experience with these kind of issues on ranches I've worked on and communities I've lived in. Through my reading, it sounds like 40% of the North Cascade elk herd is residing in a valley floor, which we feel like is unacceptable. Agricultural land in eastern Washington is not considered habitat to elk, and it shouldn't be in western Washington either. The goal, in our opinion, is not just to kill the elk and handing out tags to everybody that wants to kill one, because it basically only is treating the symptom of the problem. We feel the objective should be to change herd behavior, which is going to take a long time, but I believe that is the heart of the problem. Talking to some of our members, they're having a lot of their stored feed being affected, wrap bales being ripped open, and from what I understand, they're baling a lot of this stuff wet, so it's like a haylage. So the nutritional value in haylage is higher than a bale of hay that's just baled dry. And when that bag opens, it basically turns to mush and it has zero value. I haven't heard any of those complaints yet today, but that is a big issue. So with that, they're having to change their method of haying, baling it drier, which is in turn bringing the nutritional value of their stored feed to the winter down. That is an added value to them because they're having to buy more supplemental feed. That's for winter months. For summer months, using pastures as a rotation in a timely manner with our cattle is pretty important for the quality and quantity of our pastures. And when you have constant impact, not only from a cow, but from an elk, it reduces the quality of our pasture stands. And then over time, in very little time, it turns it into a monoculture. And a monoculture has little or no value to a cowman or wildlife, deer, all the little critters. So that is a big concern of ours. One of the things in our proposed program was using a third party as a hunting master that coordinates with all stakeholders and the timeliness of the hunts, because I believe the timing of the hunts is more important than the amount of elk you're harvesting. And over time, like I said before, they'll get trained to live where they're supposed to live. I can speak to my experiences. About 3 or 4 winters ago, we had over 400 elk down on us, and they were not leaving. And we worked with our conflict specialist, and we did harvest some elk, but that wasn't the goal. The goal was to get them back over on the other side of the elk fence. And so we'd push them the direction we'd want them to go, and as they started going up the hill, we might harvest one or two to almost put the accelerator on them. And then after they went, we got off of them. So, like cows, you're pointing them in through a gate, you take the pressure off, they should keep going the direction you want them to go. And they were back the next morning, and the next morning, and the next morning, until the helicopter came and pushed them, that same pattern we were building into them, and they went right up through a gate, finally, and left. But those were not habituated elk. They went back into their own habitat and they stayed there once the fence was fixed. I realize that's a little different with these elk because they have been habituated and it's not going to take a couple weeks to fix it like ours did, or a couple months. So thank you. I appreciate it. Any questions?
Commissioner Thorburn.
Actually, not to you, thank you. The access fee, I've heard that suggestion before. I guess I sort of looked to staff. What's the issue with allowing our landowners to... I like the idea of it as a reimbursement for time lost to their regular activities.
We had some discussion about that. Of course, the initial thing I wanted to dispel is, how is this not going to just turn into a hunting club?
Yeah.
And, a couple of damage tags that you could sell for maybe $1,500, no one's going to orient their economic reality around that. It's just exactly what you suggested, which is recompense for the time lost and the hassle. It also is creating appropriate incentives. We want these tags to be filled. We want the pressure. We want, Cedar Woolley has hundreds of people who put in for elk tags in Montana and Idaho and spend thousands of dollars to go drive over there and bring back an elk. I've been contacted by probably 20 people. How do I participate in this? So it's going to create, willing participants who, upon a phone call, are going to go out and harvest an elk. That's the intent. So to increase the success rate of the existing damage tags. That's the ultimate intent behind it, and to backfill some of the lost time.
Mr. Smith?
What was that $1,500? You just picked that one up?
I just made that up.
Okay. Yeah. is that a ballpark, do you think?
I guess it's probably just kind of my internal math of what I would pay.
Okay.
Yeah. It's willing buyer, willing seller in a sense. And another attractive piece here is, well, what about this this landowner, and if they bring somebody out who doesn't do it right, yeah. who, the landowner is best suited really to assess who among their group of friends is going to cleanly kill this elk, who's not going to fire wildly and so forth. If there's liability, it's going to fall on that landowner, so they have a big incentive to do it right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yep. You folks are going to stick around to the next panel, or you? So in case we have a bunch of questions that may come up at the end. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say we don't have any problem with what Will said. I just want to clarify we're not selling damage permits.
Right.
Just so
right.
Everybody's clear on that.
And
right.
Damage permits, the property owner has to show that the damage to be issued.
Absolutely.
By
official.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you all. Amy, who's up next?
Panel is our co-managers.
Thank you very much. Morning, gentlemen. Thanks for coming. Hi, Tina. How are you? Who goes first?
My name is Frank Bob. I'm with the Lummi Nation. I'm their natural resources policy representative. And I just wanted to make a few, present a few words today and then hand it off to my relations here. What I wanted to bring up is the importance of elk is to our people on a cultural basis. Culture is our lifeline. You might ask how important is our culture to us, to me. Culture to me is as important as the air you breathe and the water you drink for your survival. That is how important culture is to me. You take away parts of that culture, you're taking away parts of me. There's no giving back. Once something is taken, it's gone. Our people have relied on the elk from as long as I can remember. The hunters that we have out in the hills hunting today were shown those areas by their elders that walked this place before us. And they were taught and showed those places before them. And so on and so on. Like time immemorial. What is time immemorial? In the dictionary, I believe it's defined as from the beginning to now. It's not only important to us culturally, but it's spiritually related to us also. The fur and the hides of the animals were not only used for clothing and footwear, but they were made for drums. The hooves were used for ceremonial religious practices, as were the antlers. Every part of the animal that we take was used in some form or another. What we did not use, we left in the woods for the other animals. We were taught by the people that walked this place before us to respect those animals. We were here together. You take what you want, take what you need, and leave the rest. And I hear talk about treaties. Treaties is important. Point Elliott Treaty of 1855 represents 9 tribes. But before the treaties, those same people hunted those areas. before the treaties, before the settlers came in, we were there. We hunted those areas. We took care of the animals. The animals took care of us. It's a very spiritual moving thing. You take away the elk, and you take away our livelihood, our life. You take away the culture, and I am not even me. There is no me. That's how important culture is. They took away our language. They took away our religion. But we still have it. Because it was handed down to us. They tried to get rid of us. But they didn't, because we sit before you today. Those animals, we agree that they're a problem. That's why we're willing to sit at the table with WFW and try to come up with solutions to these issues and these problems. But it's going to take more than just two of us and the Cattlemen's Association and the Farm Bureau. It's got to take the other agencies, got to get involved also. The Forest Service, DNR, forest industry. Where are those animals going to go? You push them off the here and push them off the valley floor. Where are they going to go? There's no habitat up in the forested areas. With that, I'd like to yield my time to my relatives here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioner Carpenter. Or Chairman Carpenter and members of the commission, Director Sussman. Thanks, Frank, for sharing that. It's an important part of our history. The elk have always been a part of who we are as Native people and other wildlife, too. It's not just the elk. This conversation is based on elk, so I'll try and refrain from expanding. We understand the impacts to the agriculture folks, and we sympathize with them. It's their way of life. Is farming our way of life revolves around the culture, hunting, harvesting, and living in collaboration with the animals on the landscape. We appreciate all the work that is being done by the department in collaboration with the Point Elliott Treaty Tribes. I spoke at the last commission meeting, and I was faced with a question from Commissioner Holzmiller about what has been done. That kind of caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting it, so I'd like to just touch on some things that have been done by the tribes in collaboration, as well as some things that have been done by WDFW. I know you saw a presentation, and there were some key points in there. I'd just like to elaborate. So far to date, the Stillaguamish tribe, who I represent, has contributed over $263,000 to issues in the Skagit Valley, including fencing, including fertilizer, and replacement hay for farmers who were struggling. We also have dedicated over 10,000 hours over the last 6 years of staff time to the Skagit Valley issue. That includes fence building, hazing, delivery of goods, working on collaboration projects with WDFW, and even to the base level of policy meetings. We also, the tribes as a whole in the Point Elliott Treaty area played a big role in getting the grant for $300,000 for fencing for the Skagit Valley. That played a big role. Collaboratively between the tribes and what the grant provided, there was over 170,000 linear feet of fencing provided to the Skagit Valley and Acme Valley. I don't really have much else to say other than just keep an open mind and an open heart to our struggles as an entire people, and an open mind to the fact that you may not be receiving the entire story. And I would really like to put emphasis on the fact that you guys have a major resource to you for factual information coming from your department managers in Region 4. They have the information. That's what they're paid to do. Follow their lead. Thank you.
I have a question. I'd like you to clarify a little bit what you mean by we don't have the whole story. Are you leading up to something that... I mean, I'd like a better explanation.
So at the last commission meeting, I brought a fact sheet that was brought up, and there's been multiple articles labeling false information to the commission. WDFW staff in Region 4 had worked with the tribes on combating a lot of that. So I'm just keeping an open mind when you hear something that you may not be receiving the whole story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter, Vice Chair Baker, members of the committee, Director Suswin. I am excited and actually saddened a bit by coming before you today because I feel like I'm here facing my accuser. Some of the things that have been waged against tribes and the characterizations are just flat out wrong. My blood, sweat, and tears every day I wake up in this area. You know, I work, breathe, recreate, everything. I'm there. And some of the things that have been said are downright hurtful. And to say I'm frustrated is an understatement. I appreciate you as a governing body. I appreciate all the work you do. I think you are probably the most underappreciated group of volunteers there is. But that said, I think there is some room for critique on when I sit here and look at the WDFW mission statement. Is that what you work for, or do you work strictly for special interest? I mean, are we collectively co-managing things? I don't know. And I apologize for bringing a negative tone, but that tone has been set over the last couple of years and all the rhetoric that's come to this table. And I'll get to the meat and potatoes of what I came to bring you, and I apologize for prefacing it with such harsh words. First off, I'd like to second everything that my Uncle Frank said. You know, this is us. This is more than just a damaged animal or anything else. And that said, I have worked extremely hard, along with all the co-managers that you see at this table and many that aren't represented here, at finding solutions. We are not an obstacle, as been classified by this table in front of me. We are not a roadblock. We are active, capable, and engaged co-managers. We work tirelessly. We dedicate a tremendous amount of funding, staff, all the way across the board, where your agency falls short in some of the funding aspects of it. I would like to reiterate that it's a treaty resource shared with the state in all aspects. We are co-owners of this. So we shoulder the responsibility of the impacts to some of the producers. That said, some of the producers have to embrace the element of coexistence with a resource. It's no different than water, air. We can't destroy the water because we own a chunk of private property. There's regulation and protections in place for a reason, and you as a governing body are empowered to protect those. And I think, you know, for the most part, we need to get back around to that thought process. Public safety has come to this table many times. It's at the forefront of all of our agenda. We look to engage, as Fenner said, with DOT and some really meaningful, when you're looking, Commissioner McIsaac, you're looking for actions. Well, we're looking for something, but we can't control the DOT. We can't control the speed limits. We can't control, there's certain things out of our control, but we will engage and give our recommendation and try to reduce the impact to public safety. The other thing is on the news, at this table, and at numerous other tables, I keep hearing 1.4 million, 1.5 million. Have we, as co-managers, locking arms with you guys right now, have we identified who is impacted at $150,000 a year? Because I'd love to know that. This is the survey, and you guys are welcome to have this. This is a survey distributed by the county that 1.4 and $1.5 million assessment is based off of. I would like to get a third-party neutral assessor in so we can get mitigation. And mitigation, we're not looking to solve all the problems. We're not looking to get everything we want, but we could find middle ground and find a workable solution for the producers and for the co-managers and for the rec groups. We could collectively do that. But to come start throwing all these, you know, attention-grabbing numbers, and $1.5 million is, that's a huge number. I mean, is somebody willing to put their credibility on the line on a third-party neutral assessor to bring some assessor in to really get a gauge on what we have, and then what level has been welcomed by the producer? Because I know many producers that they embrace the coexistence of elk. They give their second and third cuttings. I know people who give their second cuttings to elk. And it doesn't help our overall problem. But it's like you mentioned earlier, they're going to get a damage tag and they're going to sit on it and they enjoy looking out their window and seeing elk. It is, if it's aesthetic, whatever it may be, there's an assigned value to that that can't be discounted. I think that can be said as a broader group. Again, I heard a classification today. There's the producers and there's the tribes. And you guys are stuck somewhere in the middle. But it's not like that. I work with producers every day. I'm out there. I have scars to show hands of putting up fence that I stand to benefit nothing. And I see a huge infrastructure improvement on these fencing projects where I left my blood there. So to sit here, me being critiqued about the tribes and the farmers, you know, these people, I break bread with them, I spend time with them. It is not some, like, divisive relationship as it's been painted. There is divisive relationships in any community. I mean, there's divisive relationships amongst the co-managers, but that's a mischaracterization. We've collectively asked to start setting up a public panel so we can get a better pulse on what the overall community wants, so we can see what the constituents at this table represents. You guys represent the masses, and very difficult. Like I said, my hat's off to you for the work you do, but we need to get a more broad interpretation of what the residents of the county are really looking for. A lot's been said. Fenner framed it pretty well on all of the difficulties. There's so many difficulties and dynamics we're working with. And at the end of the day, like I said, we need to achieve an acceptable mitigation. We can't, with a growing population, Mr. McIsaac, we have an urban growth area proposal by the county right now. With an urban growth area within the core of this ag area, we're going to see more impact and we're going to have more complaints, things like that. There's a lot of dynamics working, some of the zoning. So to throw a number, we're going to reduce the complaints by X number. And I feel comfortable speaking on behalf of the wildlife conflict specialist that you guys employ manages more DPCAs than your wolf program. He's busting his butt out there. I mean, to say that we're non-responsive, I heard that producers won't call because they don't get a response. I don't think the numbers match up to those statements. And I mean, I'm not trying to discount anybody or any impacts across the board, but I'm just saying we're working hard on the landscape, and we've been a non-existent player in this equation when it comes to this table specifically, but nowhere we're probably more active on the landscape than any other group. So some other things I want to touch on. You were posed a question earlier from this table that when did 9 tribes start to hunt this area, and I know you guys don't control, we're independent sovereign governments, but just to clarify that, it was codified in 1855 of a ceded area. If anybody wants to know the ceded area goes from the north slopes of Mount Rainier to the Canadian border to the Sound. Beyond that, there's probably a dozen or more tribes that hunted this area that are now excluded because of the imaginary line that we call an international border. So to, again, a misclassification, and I'd gladly provide clarification to anybody, including the commission, you know, that wants literature on treaty and its creation. Another point I want to clarify is that the 40% number is at the highest population time in the valley. When we survey the valley, it's in some of those elk are down there in critical winter range, so that's not really a number we can say those are all the resident elk. We do have a problem with resident elk. We have a problem with habituated elk. We have a problem with a lot of things. But to say, you know, just a blanket statement that we house 40% of that North Cascades elk herd is erroneous at best. I mean, I get color data that shows just prior to calving, I had elk shoot up the hill, you know, many miles to go into their summer grounds. And so it's just a few other things that, I don't know, I'm sure I'm missing a lot, but I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I appreciate it a ton. And like I said, I'm here to work with you guys. I'm here to, you know, not be an obstacle. I can't tell you how offensive it is when I hear that. We have obstacles. We have blocks. And that, Mr. McIsaac, I heard you say, someone needs to tell these guys that it's co-management, not tribal management. That has never been our mindset. And we have always had the recognition that you control the masses and try to manage the masses, not control the manage the masses. And it's a difficult task with all, you know, especially in the state, in our valley. I mean, Chair Carpenter, you know how diverse our valley is and how all of the moving parts. And
why don't you wrap it up, and then, if you don't mind, because we got public comment, and then we can do some questions from the commission to any of our number of people.
Okay,
I'll just wrap it up. I erred in the very beginning. Tino Villaluce, Swinomish Tribe.
Too late.
I also erred in the beginning. My name is Jesse Pecor, and I represent the Stillaguamish Tribe.
We know you.
One last point that I'd like to touch on is at the last commission meeting, there was a presentation by WDFW staff showing that our area was the only population that was at or above objective and still increasing. As you saw from the presentation today, that's not accurate. The number is around 1,500. The objective is between 1,700 and 1,900. And the presentation that came out at the last commission meeting was actually before the population model was ran for this year.
Okay. Quick question, then we're going to get to public comment. What was the production of new calves this year?
I'm going to defer really quick to get that question answered by Chris Madsen.
What was the production? I don't have the overall total, but there was, I believe our...
SAB.
Well, they don't even have the numbers in front of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a ballpark would be good because it's informative to us to hear what your thoughts were on calving.
Yeah, the cow-calf ratio, I believe, was in the somewhere in the 30s, low 30s for the survey period.
Is that a good number? I mean, in your mind,
that's a decent. It's not overwhelming, but it's not low either. I mean, it's for that time of the year doing a spring survey, it's decent.
Okay, thank you.
I think it was in the 30s, and I believe the cow number was in around 800. So 30 cows per calf, 800 cows. So that's a real rough. I mean, that's without having them in front of me, but that's a ballpark.
Thank you all. Thanks for coming. We'll continue on. There'll probably be some questions and comments here in just a little bit. We're going to go into the public comment part of this. For those of you that don't know, we give you 3 minutes. I don't know if Mr. Wieson's in here in the public comment period, because you're an elected official. You get more. We're going to give my good friend Sean Yannity a little time extra. He likes to talk, so we'll listen to him a little bit. I'd like to call you folks up three at a time, if we may. Janice Schweitzer, Brian Lipscomb, and Randy Good.
Good afternoon. I was moved by the last comments, and I first want to thank Amy and Fenner for all the facts that they introduced. I want to thank everybody for being willing to express their point of view, and to all the commissioners who have to listen to the varied points of view that are almost polarizing, and somehow you have to come up with a solution. I don't have any solutions, but, you know, I couldn't help but think I'm in favor of working together. We can solve the problems if we work together, and we're going to all have to compromise a little bit. But it doesn't seem like, I think I'm out.
You're all right.
You're good. Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't seem like harassing the elk or harvesting the elk is a real solution. It seems like the elk don't belong in our backyard, and they seem to have whatever numbers you want to dispute. Their numbers have increased, so let's celebrate the fact that it's not an endangered herd anymore. The bands have all increased, and that's really the problem, is how to keep them healthy and everybody's property safe. But I'm here today as a retired teacher who works in her community and school, and our bus drivers are currently at work finishing up the year. So I have collected some comments from them, and it's something that we haven't really touched on. We have video of the elk hopping the fences into the play yards, and so one thinks, well, would they really charge a student? And certainly you don't want them playing on the same grounds that the elk are standing on. You don't want them running, catching balls in the divots where the elk have been. But another factor is just getting to school. So we've given you photographs of vehicular collisions, but I hadn't really thought about school buses. The drivers in our rural districts of Cedro, Woolley, and Concrete drive 100 to 200 miles a day, and they say that seeing the elk is a daily occurrence. In the last 9 months, there have been 3 occasions where they slammed on the brakes. One driver reported in Cedro Woolley with such force that the students and the backpacks flew forward. In another case, they could see the oncoming herd of elk, so they stopped. They were great, but the oncoming traffic could not have the same view and collided with the elk, completely destroying the vehicle, and the kids had to witness this. I asked, would you think that an elk would charge? I can scare the elk with my lawnmower, you know, and I've chased them around with a horn before and not been afraid. And yet, 2 school kids, brother and sister, were taken to their house to be dropped off, and they saw the band in their front yard. And I think the school bus driver said, oh, they won't bother you. And the kids said, no, we were playing yesterday and they charged us. They ran into our house. We're not getting off the bus. So those kids rode on the bus all the way to the end of the route and came back around at the end. The herd was moved a little bit, or the band, and the bus driver walked them up to the door. So this isn't anybody's fault, but this is just a reality that we want to keep our kids safe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian?
This opportunity. I met with you in April, and I gave you my spiel then, so I won't repeat that. It's online. I still don't hunt, and I still don't fish. But I'm actually kind of disturbed a little bit about what seems to be the relationship between the white man and the Indian, it appears. I mean, I thought that was all done. And it's almost like, do we need to go get in a room, have a fight, get it out, and get back together and get along with each other? This is, it shouldn't be happening this way. And tribal members that I talk to and all that, they're not like this. But it seems like when we get in this environment like this, you know, we become us versus them. And that's not the way it should be. Anyway, that's not what I came here to say. So I'm just going to read, if you haven't heard, the Capital Press's editorial. I just wanted to read that if you haven't had the opportunity. This is from Don Jenkins. He says, when state wildlife managers moved elk into the Skagit Valley, they took responsibility for them, as did the Native American tribes who helped with the effort. But now that there's a problem with too many elk, neither the state nor the tribes want to take responsibility for thinning the elk herd. They offer a certain amount of lip service, but now that the cost of the damage to farmers and ranchers in the valley has toppled $1.4 million, the rhetoric has been dialed down to a whisper. It should be noted that 10% of those losses were at a single blueberry farm. We can tell you which one that is if you're curious. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has only said it will offer a new plan on June 14th. We've seen that plan. According to Regional Director Amy Windrow, the plan will target larger groups of elk on farmland instead of using a scattershot approach. Elk are a huge problem in parts of the Northwest where wildlife managers appear to be unwilling or unable to manage the wildlife. They seem to wait until someone blows a gasket over massive losses caused by elk, and only then do they come up with a plan. In the meantime, the elk eat crops, wreck fences, and let livestock out and interfere with cattle. In addition, they create traffic hazards and leave waste on school grounds where children play. A school bus driver reportedly nearly hitting an elk three times during the past year. She slammed on the brakes hard enough to cause the bus to lurch and as the elk crossed the road. And anyone who objects to this elk is just supposed to grin and bear it. Put up with it, as they say. You know, it's very frustrating. When the Fish and Wildlife Department brought the last batch of elk into the area in 2002, it had a plan to control them. WDFW will adopt a zero-tolerance policy in responding to any damage occurring as a result of elk introductions. That was the 2002 plan, according to the 2002 North Cascades Elk Herd Plan. The quote, the contingency plan prioritizes lethal removal of offending animals as opposed to spending considerable time and expense relocating problem elk and they that are likely to repeatedly return to the damaged areas, the habitual elk. Considering how the department has ignored its 2002 plan, the people of Skagit County shouldn't hold their breath about the new and improved plan. It may be a fine plan, but if the department doesn't follow it, what is the point? Thank you. Also, if I could add, I read your 2018 and 2002 one. That quoted up 3,000 was the top of the herd. So we do need to get our data together and find out what is the source of this data, because there is conflicting information out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Randy?
Randy Good, Cedar Woolley. Recap of the... Everyone hear me?
Yes, sir.
I can't tell if it's going on. The recap of the imported elk intrusion damages on the private ag lands, which is 0.5% of the herd plan area. That blue or that pink area you saw on that map earlier, that's 0.5%, and that's where 38% of the elk live. County commissioners, county assessor, mayor, two school superintendents, school board members, veterinarians, farmers, retired teachers, homeowners have all expressed their concerns on DFW's failed management of elk, resulting in safety and financial losses for the last 10 years to farms, schools, homes, and highways in Skagit County. The county assessor's completed survey shows $1.41 million in annual costs and damages due to elk intrusions, with 107 farms reporting covering 5,100 acres. This survey does not include damages to farms not enrolled in the open space program. Time and labor, school damages, homeowners damages, and loss on the highways. And for anyone that wants to get that info, just talk to the county assessor, Dave Thomas. Safety of school children must be a top priority. The imported elk have caused major damage, as Janice was saying. Cedar Woolley and Concrete students face serious safety issues daily on the bus route and the playgrounds. Now elk in Concrete and Lyman are intruding through the towns, creating safety issues. As farmers, we are liable if our livestock get out on the roads. Why isn't DFW liable for elk damages? Four sheriff vehicles, one total. Ambulances forced to stop en route to hospitals. Average of one elk vehicle collision per week on Highway 20. Example of one farmer. Of the 107, livestock bull was gored by the elk. Four livestock lost to hoof rot. Elk living on private property for 8 months a year. Has to check and fix fences daily, costing $4,000 yearly on just materials. And time and labor not included in that. His wife was injured trying to get livestock in due to the elk damaging the fence. And it ended up with a trip to the emergency room and another day shot when he could have been doing other chores. Elk collar data proves that elk are roaming mountain areas north of Highway 20 through the ag floor and across Skagit River to the south. Daily data clearly shows hoof rot has been spread throughout Eastern County. No reason now why supplement and feeding of the elk in the state and federal areas cannot happen. You have heard solutions from the panel of Don Will, of Ron Wiesen, Will Honey, and Danny. Doesn't DFW have an obligation to obey state law, RCW 770412? Require it. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Appreciate it. We have two more left. Sean Yannity and Bill Huebner.
yield to my elder.
Oh, my. Sean, why don't you introduce yourself to the folks that may not know who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Sean Yannity. I'm chairman and fisheries manager for the Stillaguamish Tribe of Indians.
Do you also the vice chair of the Northwest Indian Fish Commission, also, correct?
Yep.
Any more?
One of the committee members for the local governmental advisory committee. I can go on and on with
Your wife, has a nickname for you, too. So much.
And also the chairman of the, as I was reminded, of the Northwest Indian Fish Commission's Wildlife Committee. Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity, fellow commissioners, and Director Susswin. On behalf of the Stillaguamish Tribe, we've been working on protecting our culture and our way of life, how the elk and deer, bear, the salmon sustain our culture, our health. Back in 1998, I started getting involved with the elk issue, sitting in meetings at the DNR office up there in Cedar Woolley with the other tribes, along with DNR, Department of Fish and Wildlife, working on the North Cascades Elk Herd Plan. Then we moved on to the relocation plan. Then we moved on to the relocation project. Through that, we went through several public meetings down in Tootle, as well as there in Mount Vernon, going over the plan, how we were going to handle things. And a lot of those meetings were pretty brutal. The tribes got blamed for everything down in Tootle. The tribes got blamed for everything in Mount Vernon. We were the destruction of the herds. We were the problems for the elk herds down in St. Helens area. We made a commitment that we were going to help manage this elk herd to not only meet the needs of our communities, but also for the state of Washington as well. It's a prized hunt. You guys have a lot of hunters that want to get those elk permits. It's one of the healthiest herds we got. It produces some great trophy animals out of there. But for the tribes, this isn't a trophy hunt. We've gotten some nice bulls in Indian country. But we're not a recreational hunt. You know, as my relative Frank from Lummi was explaining, it's hard to explain to somebody that doesn't live in our shoes and our culture why it's so important to the way of our way of life. So many parts of that animal sustains our culture, our regalia, our drums. They're in our stories, they're in our songs, they're part of our ceremonies. Not being able to have a funeral, or having elk for a funeral, or a naming, or even deer meat, is like asking the Catholics not to have wine or bread in communion. We don't have a culture if we don't have the resources to exercise that culture. And I say that also with our salmon in the Stillaguamish. And you guys know the issues that we face in fisheries with the Stillaguamish Chinook. We don't have salmon. We don't have a culture. We don't have elk. We don't have a culture. It's tied to our health. It's tied to all of our teachings. And we shared that in some of our public meetings down in Tootle. We even went to some of the schools and worked with a lot of the kids there. We did 3 field trips down to schools in Tootle to talk about the elk, the management. The first meeting, the department wasn't with us. After that, they were. We made a commitment that we knew that there's going to be some impacts to agriculture. as you heard, that, you know, the department made a commitment in the elk herd plan to remove elk, but it was a little mischaracterized. The elk that were going to be removed were called the ones that were transferred. So when we moved elk, we collared them. If those elk ended up on the valley floor, those are the ones that were going to be taken out. It isn't any elk that comes down on the valley floor gets taken out. You have three tribes here today sharing their concerns. We each speak for our own communities. You have nine other tribes, and it's difficult for us to get our government to government with a commission when our government to government is actually with a governor. So it's very difficult for us to work it, because there's different placements of structure of government with the state of Washington where we have to fit in, try to get into the public comment. We're not public, and you guys know that. But so we try to fit in and get our comments in as best we can. The damage hunts that are in place are not designed to improve success. I heard that today. That it was, why isn't it as successful? Why isn't there more harvested? The implementation of that program is to reduce damage, to reduce conflict, not to intentionally increase the success rate of filling those permits. There's a social tolerance that we've got to deal with that interferes with the science of management of wildlife. And unfortunately, it's the one-sided social tolerance, the ones that don't want elk. What about the social tolerance of the ones that want elk? We got to find a way to make solutions. We want solutions. We want to find a way to come to terms to this. We said that from the beginning. All nine of us tribes have made that commitment of doing something, and we've done it. My members have been out there putting up fences as well. We paid for somebody's hay. We paid for somebody's lie to refertilize their field. We've gained friends. We got some folks that still are cautious with the tribes being involved. I was given the numbers for the recruitment that you guys were asking for. So it's 35 to 39 calves per 100 cows. And with the two studies, it came to 865 cows and a total population in the survey area of 1,493. And I know we focus on the Skagit, and people lose sight of the Nooksack elk herd being on the Skagit floor. It's not. It's from the Canadian border all the way down into King County. We'd love to see elk in our homelands. We'd love to see elk back in the Still of Guamish. We've got the documentation pre-treaty of folks testifying, our family, our ancestors, of hunting elk all over the place in the Point Elliott Treaty area. Hunting elk in the Still of Guamish Valley, specific areas and how we hunted them. Hunting them with dogs, hunting them at night, hunting them, chasing them through canyons. So we just can't reiterate more that we've got top-notch staff in Indian Country that work with the department, work with our landowners and the local communities on trying to find solutions. And you've heard that commitment here today, and I know it's there. Have we all disagreed? Ever since the day we started working on that elk herd plan, there was disagreement amongst the DFW, the tribes, and even amongst us tribes. But we always found a way to get the job done. When we started the translocation, I remember on the second one, myself and the department were going round and round about capture. But we found solutions. We got it done. We can do it here. We're at the table. We're gonna find a way. I thank you for the time. Sorry if I went a little too long, but I just want to thank you guys for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Sean. Bill?
Good morning. At least I think it's still morning. My name is Bill Huebner. I am an employee of the Stillaguamish Tribe, and although I'm an employee of the Stillaguamish Tribe, I'm not representing the tribe today. I come to you with a little bit of history in elk management in the Skagit Valley. Prior to my employment with the Stillaguamish Tribe, I spent 38 years with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I was in the enforcement program, and the last 20 years of my career I spent as the captain in Region 4. And during my tenure as captain, I was responsible for the elk management and the management of the damage, the elk damage in the Skagit Valley. And like Chairman Yannity, I was involved in a number of the different elk management decisions to include the translocation. And I'm here to tell you that there were elk in the Skagit Valley prior to the translocation. There were a number of elk. In fact, there were in-house discussions of whether or not the translocation was really necessary. My assertion is I think there'd be elk in the same numbers there are today in the Skagit Valley, even without the translocation. The elk were increasing, and there was a harvest moratorium, and we were getting there. The translocation sped up the recovery. I'm here to make two points. I'm going to tell you what those points are. First, I want to emphasize just how difficult and what a challenge the elk management issues are. They're very complex. They're not just in this elk herd, but throughout the state, regardless of what elk herd you're talking about. And the second point would be I'd like to very humbly and respectfully offer the commission a suggestion. But before I do that, and long as I've got the floor, I'd like to also recognize Deputy Director Joe Storr for the marvelous job that he's done with the 12 years he's been with the agency. I worked with him side by side. We managed some very difficult issues, and he's a top-notch guy. And I also welcome Amy Windrup into the new position. She'll be a wonderful addition to the director's office, and I'm very optimistic about the future of the department and its leadership. First, the complex issues with the elk. What do I mention? I think you've heard it all today. You've heard a lot of different things, but I'd like to emphasize the legal and moral obligation that we have with the treaty rights. There is a treaty, it is the law of the land, and I think we have a moral obligation to pay attention to that. And oftentimes, co-management or treaty rights is a last consideration when actually it should be a first consideration. We've heard about the political pressure, we've heard about the difficulties with the small land ownerships in the Skagit Valley, we've heard about landowners that actually like elk and manage elk, buy property for elk. We have entities, whether it's the Seattle City Light or whoever it might be. Have I already reached 3 minutes? I heard. Okay. All of those are compounded with false acts or false information, false facts that are out there. Commissioner Carpenter, you asked, Chairman Carpenter, you asked about what some of those false facts were. And, you know, referring to elk as invasive species, insinuating that hoof rot is being spread to the livestock industry by elk, and that's not backed up by science. It might be the case, but it might not be the case. That investigation is in progress and is being undertaken. The translocation, the elk were released during the translocation in the city of Concrete or in the lowland neighborhoods. That simply was not the case. I was personally involved. I personally escorted elk, or my staff escorted elk from Mount St. Helens to the Three Sisters area, as high elevation as we could get. There was testimony in front of the legislature that the tribes received $500 per elk for every roadkill, and that's totally absurd, but it took time and effort by the tribes to address those false assertions. And now we're dealing with these exaggerated damage claims on the Skagit Valley. It's not helpful. We need accurate information to base those decisions on. And that brings me to my final point. How do we get those accurate informations? Well, and accurate data. First off, I commend Chairman Carpenter, Director Seuswind, Amy Windrup, and others who have actually attended these public meetings. I've got a long and extensive career in fish and wildlife management, and I'm here to tell you that you have probably the finest staff that there is, not just in Washington, but nationwide, dealing with this issue. They're educated, they're trained, they're committed, they live in the community, they're part of the community, and they're dedicated to finding solutions that work. We've heard about problems, but we haven't talked about any of the successes, and there are successes. There's some 36 landowners who had elk damage, and those damage complaints have been resolved or minimized, and they're continuing to pursue their livelihood of producing. And once, it's just the very nature of things. Those people that are happy don't complain. But if you're looking for the truth, I strongly suggest turn to your staff. They're the experts. And I think I'll end on a tribal a saying, and that is, we don't inherit the land from our ancestors. We borrow it from our children. And I think we have an obligation to manage and protect our resources for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you all. I would expect there's probably some questions or comments from the... Really? Well, I have one. No surprise. This issue goes back a long way, in my mind. Not as far back as in others that have been here longer than I. There's a few of you in the room. But what I've seen in the last 6-8 months, I'll use that as a time frame, is I've seen some significant progress in moving towards finding agreement, solutions, and opportunities to go forward in a much more balanced way. Not everything is fixed. I do want to say from the agricultural side, I really have appreciated those individuals coming in front of us, calling me, educating me and us. I also want to thank Commissioner Wiesen and Mr. Honey. I think your folks' involvement is really appropriate and balanced in trying to protect the landowners and do what's right for the county. No question about that. The tribal representatives, really, it was a great opportunity to have you folks here today. I hope we can continue this dialogue on a somewhat regular basis and try and put the rabbit back in the hole here and move forward. So that's all I got to say, because I heard your stomach rumbling there, Sean. Yeah, Tino.
I'd just like to make one more comment. Parting comment is I extended an invitation to Chair Carpenter to come out, and also Chair Smith when you were chairman. I extend that invitation to the entire commission. If you'd like to come up and spend a day with us, you know, see the work we're doing. And I apologize for bringing such a sour taste to this table, but like I said, it was rooted. And I'd like to, I guess, validate the tribal WDFW relationship is as strong as ever. We work very cohesively with your staff. It wasn't, but there was just a lot of angst, and I apologize for that. But like I said, I just wanted to extend that invitation to the entire commission. Anytime, I'll make time if you guys need it individually or as a group. Thank you.
I forgot one thing, but I don't want to fail to do this. This improvement in communication and moving the ball down the field, I give a ton of thanks to Amy. And your leadership and ability to engage with people, Amy, is a real, real quality that most people don't have. So I welcome you in the director's office, and we expect to keep moving the ball down the field.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. One thing that I forgot to mention on the I think it was about 2014. We were trying to find the date when this happened, but Nate Pamplin was part of it. We put together, the DFW put together committees up there to deal with issues, work groups, and there was damage committee, enhancement committee, herd population committee. There's like five of them, and I sat on the damage committee.
And they had several agricultural folks on that committee and people that were concerned about road collision. That was the other road collision committee. And it started out that they wanted 95% of the elk population reduced. By the time we got done with those committees, everybody agreed that that if we reduce the complaints by 95%, does it matter how many animals are in the elk herd? If you don't have complaints, does the population matter? And I think that's something we shouldn't lose sight of, because if we reduce the risks, reduce the complaints, we can still meet the needs of harvest for the tribes as well as for the state. I think we could be successful.
Look forward to hearing more. Okay. Anything else, Amy? Or are you, is that a wrap for you? Okay.